he'd received from all the people who admired him. "I loved that person, too," she lamented. "But I don't think that person is sitting right there." Huguette gestured toward Donaldson, who hunched impassively at the defense counsel's table. "I don't think that's the same person at all," she said. "I don't think he's taken responsibility, and I think the only way he's going to get it is if he has to sit in prison." Looking at Donaldson with a conflicted expression that conveyed both sincere concern and utter revulsion, Huguette said to him, "And honestly, I think you deserve to be raped every day until you understand the pain you have caused me. Until you understand what this does to you emotionally. Until you get it, Beau. Until you are actually sorry. Until you can take responsibility and get help. And I truly hope that you can come out of this a person of quality, a person of substance. I hope after you are punished and after you get it, that you have a great life. Until then, I don't care what happens to you." Taking the witness stand was difficult for Allison Huguette. She knew most of the people in the gallery, and many of them were attending the hearing to offer her moral support. But at least as many people were openly supporting Beau Donaldson, including several individuals she'd previously considered friends of her family. Seeing them sitting on Donaldson's side of the courtroom was exceedingly hurtful, and she had trouble controlling her emotions as she testified. Several times Huguette had to fight back tears, and it looked like she might not be able to proceed. On each occasion, however, she willed herself to regain her composure and continued to speak her piece. It was a remarkable display of courage. Huguette is a warm, cheerful woman. She doesn't look fierce, but her upbeat demeanor that day hid an abundance of tenacity. When defense counsel Milt Datsopoulos began his cross-examination of Huguette, he had no idea what was in store for him. Datsopoulos began not by asking Huguette a question, but by lecturing her. "I just want to explain to you," he pronounced, "why certain things happened. Beau admitted on at least three different occasions that he took advantage of you, that he had sex with you without consent. He said he was guilty of doing things to you without your consent that were horrible. I think it's important for you to know that he has consistently told various people, but most importantly law enforcement, 'I made a horrible mistake. I committed a crime. I had sex with my friend. She did not give consent.' Charges were then filed, and we came to court and pled not guilty at Donaldson's arraignment. That outrages a lot of people. It's hard to understand how that occurs when you've already admitted your guilt, like Beau did." Datsopoulos explained to Allison that when Donaldson made the not guilty plea at his arraignment, he wasn't actually claiming that he wasn't guilty. It was merely a procedural formality. "I understand that," Huguette replied. "I just hope that makes you feel a little better," Datsopoulos offered. "No, it doesn't make me feel better," she said. "What would make me feel better is if he told his family and friends the truth so that they don't go around bashing on me and attacking me. You know, that would make me feel better." Trying a different tack, Datsopoulos said, "The thing that I was pleased to hear was that you're not here to destroy Beau." Datsopoulos pointed out that Huguette said that she wanted Beau Donaldson to acknowledge the harm he did to her and her family, and that he needs professional help, and that you want him to get that professional help. "In Deer Lodge," Huguette interjected, referring to the state prison. "And you also want him to be able to recover and become somebody," Datsopoulos suggested hopefully. "He's got a good mind, doesn't he?"
"He's got a sick mind," Huguette countered.
"I don't know what happened to Beau, to be honest to you. Like I said, I don't know that person sitting there." She gestured again at Donaldson. "I knew the person I was growing up with. I loved that person. But I'm not willing to speak about his character now or in the future, because I don't know this person." Milt Datsopoulos tried to get Huguette to acknowledge that Beau Donaldson would benefit from psychiatric counseling. She concurred, then added, "I'm requesting that he be sent to prison, too. I definitely think he needs to be punished as well."
"I agree that he needs to be punished," Datsopoulos said, "but there are various forms of punishment."
"Donaldson," he insisted, "is remorseful. He's going through a lot of pain. Yeah, he's scared. He's sad that he's in this situation. But he's also agonizing over the damage he's done to you."
We have differing opinions on that, Allison Huguette declared.
The final witness to appear for the prosecution was Katie Burton, the probation and parole officer who'd written the pre-sentence investigation report about Beau Donaldson, which urged Judge Townsend to follow the state's recommendation and sentence him to 30 years at Deer Lodge, with 20 years suspended. Prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburg began by asking why Burton thought her recommendation was the appropriate sentence that should be imposed, given the wide range of potential sentences Townsend was free to choose, from no incarceration at all to 100 years of hard time.
I think there needs to be some punishment, Burton answered. To take advantage of someone when they're sleeping, to take away their feeling of safety around other people, it's heinous. I mean, it's a horrible thing to have that person ever feel that they can't feel safe around other people. I think that the Montana State Prison is appropriate, given that this was an adult taking advantage of an adult who had been friends with him for years and years and years. Katie Burton added that Donaldson needed treatment for his substance abuse and sexual deviancy. I think rehabilitation is very important, she said. But I think that he needs to do some of it at the Montana State Prison and recognize how horrible his actions really are. Then Valkenburg asked, You understand, Katie, that if he were to get a 10-year prison sentence, that he would be eligible for parole after serving 2.5 years of that sentence?
That's correct, she said. Yes.
So basically, if he does what he's required to do while he's in prison, he's likely to get paroled?
That would be my guess, Burton replied, as long as he completes treatment.
She recommended to Judge Townsend that Donaldson be required to complete both chemical dependency treatment and sex offender treatment while incarcerated at the Montana State Prison before he was deemed eligible for parole. Because this was a sentencing hearing rather than a trial, Judge Townsend was free to question witnesses, and she wasn't shy about doing so. One of the matters that has been discussed in this case, she said, or at least bandied about, is whether or not Mr. Donaldson should be considered for the boot camp program. She was referring to a 120-day military-style boot camp at the Treasure State Correctional Training Center. This had been suggested by Milt Datsopoulos as an alternative to incarceration in the state prison. Do you have any opinion about that as a potential proposal? Townsend asked Katie Burton.
I think the boot camp is a great program, Burton replied. It's probably one of my favorites. The only problem I find with the boot camp is they don't do sex offender treatment in there.
So he could not, in fact, get the sex offender treatment that you're recommending if he were a boot camp inmate?
No, Burton answered. He would not.
Chapter 19. After Katie Burton was excused, Milt Datsopoulos called the first witness for the defense, Bob Eustace, a teacher at Big Sky High School who had coached football and basketball and taught health when Beau Donaldson and Allison Huguette were students there. Datsopoulos asked him, Why are you here? Why do you think it's important?
I think it's gut-wrenching, Coach Eustace answered, looking ill at ease, that, you know, obviously, somebody has been violated and harmed. The things that I have seen from Beau, you know, he's been trustworthy. He's been respectful. He had empathy for others, so it seems very out of character that he would perform this type of act.
Datsopoulos asked Eustace, What are some of the characteristics that you've observed, some of the persona of this guy that you think is important for the judge to consider?
I think what I saw, especially in the classroom or as a coach, was that he treated other people extremely well, Eustace replied. Obviously, we try to prevent bullying and stuff like that, but there's kids who were younger and very small and were bullied by kids who were older than they were. And, you know, Beau came in, stepped up, and protected those kids and made sure that they weren't harmed. So, you know, I had a lot of respect for that.
Datsopoulos said, You and I spoke just once before today, and one of the comments you made during that conversation was that you really do not believe that Beau Donaldson should go to prison, even though he admitted to a very serious criminal act here. Why do you say that?
I think that the Beau Donaldson I knew, Eustace said, I wouldn't think that he would reoffend. I think, you know, granted, you know, obviously this has escalated and created huge amounts of problems and grief for the victim's family, and just a terrible situation. That's why I say I think he has empathy, and that I would feel secure that he wouldn't reoffend. So that would be my personal opinion on that. A few minutes later, Datsopoulos asked Coach Eustace if he believed this type of crime required some punishment.
It's one of the worst crimes I think a person can commit, Eustace replied, to be honest with you.
This didn't seem to be the response Milt Datsopoulos had been hoping for. Appearing flummoxed, he inquired, Is there anything else you want to say, Mr. Eustace? Eustace launched into a rambling, largely incoherent riff.
You know, from the time that I've known Beau and known him well, I just thought that, you know, when I judge kids, and I try not to judge them, I try to lead them on and help them as far as school, but, you know, there's some kids I'm really concerned with as far as what their course is and where they're going to end up. You know, Beau really never was in that category, and, you know, I would think that he would definitely be able to change his life around.
Are you concerned if he spends any significant time in prison that it could damage his prospects and who he is? Datsopoulos asked.
Well, my thoughts on prison is, Eustace answered. The fact is, you put a person in there because that person could harm somebody else in society. If I thought he was going to harm somebody in society again, I would never testify for him.
Thank you, Datsopoulos said. I have no further questions. Prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburg began his cross-examination by asking, Mr. Eustace, you think that this is one of the worst crimes that anyone can commit, but you don't think Beau Donaldson should go to prison, even though he committed one of the worst crimes there is.
I think it's a terrible crime, Coach Eustace agreed, but he suggested that one of the worst punishments a person could suffer was harm to his reputation, and Donaldson's reputation has been destroyed. You know, he's got a felony. There's no use for him to go back to school. What professional job can he get? You know, look what's happened to his family. And I would definitely concur with the fact that he should get treatment for chemical and sex offender.
Does Big Sky High School have rules? Van Valkenburg asked.
They do, Eustace answered.
And when people violate those rules, do they get punished?
We like to think so, yes.
Why do they get punished?
To keep order and to make sure that things run correctly.
And does that help other students who don't violate the rules know that if they do violate the rules, they might get punished too? Van Valkenburg asked.
Eustace tried to dodge the question by suggesting that because of the school's confidentiality policy, most students would be unaware of any disciplinary action against other students. But Van Valkenburg kept pressing.
So if a football player gets kicked off the team or is not allowed to play, nobody knows that? He asked.
Eustace continued to dodge.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we have teacher-student confidentiality and that I can't talk to students in my class.
Van Valkenburg tried a different angle.
Did you learn anything about Beau Donaldson this morning?
I was heartbroken for Allison, Eustace replied. I'll be honest with you. It was so hard to listen to that testimony.
It was terrible, yes.
I have no further questions, Your Honor, Van Valkenburg said.
Anything further? Judge Townsend asked Datsopoulos.
Nothing more, Your Honor, he replied, and then he asked if his witness could be excused from the courtroom.
I'd like to ask him a question, Townsend pronounced, to the surprise and visible dismay of both Milt Datsopoulos and Coach Eustace.
I didn't hear an answer to either of the attorney's questions about, do you think Beau Donaldson should be punished?
Punished in what way, Judge? Eustace inquired.
I'm asking you whether he deserves any kind of punishment, and then if your answer is yes, I want to know what kind you think he ought to have.
I think that Beau can be a productive member of society, Eustace said.
I think he can help society, and I think he could be a positive member of society. I think definitely I believe he should go through alcohol treatment, sex offender treatment, and successfully complete those two treatments.
For me, prisons didn't really benefit the person being incarcerated. Were they rehabilitated? I didn't think so. So how many people have to go back and go back? That worries me. I think Beau can be productive.
So, Judge Townsend declared, looking peeved, I still don't think I have an answer to my question. You seem to be avoiding it.
Well, Eustace said, my thought is if he was put on whatever, suspension, or is sentenced.
Cutting him off, Townsend interjected. So he gets a free pass, is what you're saying.
I don't think it's a free pass, Eustace protested. I think he should be made to come in and, you know, go through those treatments. Don't we have a system that can monitor him and do that?
So he checks in once a month, Townsend said. He has to tell his probation officer where he's living, and he has to go to treatment. You think that's enough in this case?
If he violates that, Eustace offered, we can always send him to jail, can't we?
You think that's enough for what he did in this case? Townsend demanded. Eustace replied with a non sequitur.
The beau I had previously known, to be honest with you, was a decent kid.
And so what you heard today doesn't change your mind about who this person is? Townsend asked.
Eustace started to answer with yet another dodge. I am devastated with what happened with Allison. I can't...
Impatient with his refusal to answer her questions, Townsend interrupted to ask, was she your student too?
I did not have Allison in class, he said.
But he told Townsend that he taught sex education, so I understand the implications of, you know, having sex without consent. Judge Townsend had begun to suspect that when Eustace had agreed to testify on Donaldson's behalf, he'd been led to believe that the sex between Donaldson and Allison was consensual, and had no idea that Donaldson had raped Allison while she was asleep and then chased her down an alley. To confirm her suspicion, Townsend asked Eustace, "But you did not know, really, all the details before you showed up today. Am I correct in assuming that?"
"I would say it's a terrible crime," Eustace prattled on, ignoring the question yet again. "I'm glad I'm not in your shoes, but it's a terrible crime, and I think there's no way Allison couldn't have negative effects from that. You know, do our schools give kids second chances? We try to give them second chances. I don't know, you know, what kind of second chance you give a person, you know, in this system. You know, do you put them in jail and he becomes a criminal? I don't know. That seems, from my perspective, to be what happens in our criminal justice system."
Realizing that Coach Eustace was never going to provide a direct answer to her original question, should Beau Donaldson be sent to prison for raping Allison Huguette, Judge Townsend gave up. She allowed Milt Ditsopoulos to ask Eustace a few softball questions, and then she told the coach, "Thank you, sir. You may step down. You're excused." Allison Huguette was seated in the gallery with her family and her friend Keeley Williams, trying to suppress the pain and bilious rage she felt as Eustace testified in support of Beau Donaldson. It was incredibly unnerving that Mr. Eustace and other male staff from our high school came to the trial to support Beau, Williams recalled. It was like a kick in the gut to Allison.
"It was extremely hurtful," Allison agreed, her emotions boiling to the surface as she remembered the moment. "Eustace teaches sex education to high school kids, and he refused to say that Beau needed to be punished even after confessing to raping me. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. What kind of message does that send to his students?"
Although Karen Townsend had been a judge for only 3 years, she'd earned wide respect from the Missoula Bar for her fairness and legal acumen. Before being elected district court judge in Montana's 4th Judicial District, she'd served for 8 years as Chief Deputy Missoula County Attorney under Fred Van Valkenburg, and had spent 18 years prior to that working as a Deputy Missoula County Attorney. The challenge she faced at Beau Donaldson's sentencing hearing, as her questioning of Bob Eustace suggested, was to arrive at a punishment that was proportional to the seriousness of Donaldson's crime, while at the same time providing an opportunity for his rehabilitation. The difficulty of reconciling these aims became increasingly apparent as the hearing continued. The next witness for the defense was John Peterson, a Missoula drywall contractor who was a childhood friend of Beau's father, Larry Donaldson. Peterson's kids had grown up with Beau Donaldson and Allison Huguette in the Target Range neighborhood. Donaldson didn't seem to be a typical jock, Peterson testified. He didn't act privileged. From an early age, Peterson had made a point of having his son and daughter work for him. I want them to understand what it's like to actually have to earn a living, he explained. For that reason, he'd hired their friends as well, including Donaldson. Beau was always one of the first ones I'd call. My trade is a physical trade. He seemed to excel at it. Over the previous year, following Donaldson's arrest, Peterson said he'd employed him on dozens of construction sites. You couldn't ask for a better employee. He's very respectful to the other people that work with me, all the other tradesmen on the jobs. It's hard to go somewhere where somebody doesn't know Beau. And he's always been greeted with handshakes and hugs. You know, it doesn't seem to me that he's a threat to society. You've certainly heard this morning some frankly heart-wrenching testimony, Milt Datsopoulos observed. What do you make of that? Like Mr. Eustace, do you believe Beau should be punished for this? Certainly, Peterson answered. I believe Beau should be punished for this. All those nice things I've just said about Beau, I can say about Allison. I've been to her birthday parties. I've coached her in softball. This is an awful, terrible place to be right now. If I was Superman, I'd spin the earth around backwards and I'd make all of this go away. Beau is a friend. I don't want him to go to prison. No matter what the court does today, Datsopoulos said, Beau will be leaving here in handcuffs. And at some point, he'll be back in the community. When he's out, would you rehire him as an employee? Yes, I would, Peterson replied. We all know where Beau is headed, what he had in front of him. All those doors are closed. The only one that's remotely cracked open is the one I have, you know, a tradesman. He's a hard worker, and I could train him to do it. I don't know what else to do. John Peterson was articulate and genuine on the stand, a very effective witness for Beau Donaldson. But Fred Van Valkenburgh is a skilled litigator, and after Milt Datsopoulos sat down, Van Valkenburgh began his cross-examination with a perfectly aimed strike. Mr. Peterson, he said. At the very beginning of the testimony here, you told us you have a daughter? Yes, sir, Peterson replied. How old is she? She's 26 years old. So, if Beau Donaldson had chosen to rape your daughter instead of Allison, Van Valkenburgh asked, how would that affect your testimony today? Well, Peterson answered, I'd be testifying as Mr. Huguette did, not as an impartial person. That's apples and oranges. Allison Huguette and Kristen Peterson are two separate people. I guess they are, Van Valkenburgh mused, because Kristen didn't get raped, did she? But basically what you're telling us is you'd have the same reaction Mr. Huguette did. I'm sure I would. If Donaldson had raped Kristen Peterson instead of Allison Huguette, Van Valkenburgh demanded, that would tell you something a hell of a lot different about Beau Donaldson, wouldn't it? Hypothetically, I don't know, Peterson stammered. A moment later, he conceded, I guess, yes. Chapter 20. Before his sentencing hearing, Beau Donaldson was ordered to undergo psychosexual evaluations by two different psychologists, one hired by the defense, the other hired by the prosecution, to determine how likely he was to rape again, and to assess his potential for responding favorably to sex offender therapy. When the psychologist who performed the first evaluation, Dr. Robert Page, appeared at the hearing as a witness for Donaldson, Milt Datsopoulos asked him to explain the purpose of evaluating his client. The purpose, Dr. Page answered, was to obtain information about his personality traits and the risk he posed to the community, in order to provide the most responsible recommendations for not only the rehabilitation of the individual, but rehabilitation in the least restrictive environment, while maintaining safety to society. Page added that all the data he'd analyzed suggested that Donaldson was within the low to moderate risk range. According to Page, his evaluation also showed that Donaldson would respond well to sex offender therapy while living in the community, as long as he was monitored for abstinence from drugs and alcohol 100%. Datsopoulos asked Dr. Page if Beau Donaldson was remorseful, sincerely remorseful, and contrite for his actions. At this point, Page said, I believe he's got some remorse. I just can't put my finger on exactly whether or not that's absolutely genuine, in terms of the effect of his actions on the victim, or whether it's, you know, more related to a fear, of the punishment he might receive. So, Paige explained, I would be irresponsible telling you that I know there's genuine remorse going on in Beau Donaldson right now. When it was his turn to cross-examine Dr. Paige, Prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburg asked him about the importance of punishing Donaldson, not only in terms of his rehabilitation, but also for Allison Huggett's recovery from being raped. Van Valkenburg pointed out to Paige, I think you said, based on your work with victims, one of the things that victims really need is a sense of retribution. Is that what you meant? Dr. Paige answered, one of the things that victims respond to therapeutically is the retribution of the perpetrator. That's true. Retribution, Van Valkenburg continued, primarily involves the punishment of the perpetrator, in the sense that if the victim feels that there has been some retribution or punishment, it's easier for her to heal than if the victim thinks that the perpetrator essentially got away with what he did. Well stated, Paige said. Yes. A couple of minutes later, Van Valkenburg asked Dr. Paige about a clinical interview of Beau Donaldson he'd done. Would it be fair to say that Mr. Donaldson's account of what happened, what he told you in that clinical interview, differed very significantly from what was set out in the police reports? Yes, Dr. Paige replied. And would it be fair to say that he essentially tried to tell you in that interview that he really didn't commit the offense of sexual intercourse without consent, because he thought this woman was consenting to what he was doing? I would interpret it that way at the time, Paige agreed. Denial was not uncommon in perpetrators undergoing this kind of evaluation, he said. It's an indication of the necessity for aggressive sex offender treatment. And it's also, I guess, an indication that if he's not being truthful with you in the clinical interview, you're not getting the whole picture, Van Valkenburg parried. Yeah, the psychologist reluctantly conceded. But Dr. Paige insisted that he was nevertheless able to discern enough about Donaldson to recognize a lack of accountability that needs to be addressed in treatment. The more pertinent question, Paige said, was whether such sex offender treatment needed to be done in a residential setting or not to be effective. After Dr. Paige was excused from the courtroom, the defense called its next witness, Dr. Jim Myers, the psychologist who'd been hired in advance of the hearing by the prosecution to conduct the second psychosexual evaluation of Beau Donaldson. Like Dr. Paige, Dr. Myers testified that his assessment indicated that Donaldson was a low risk to reoffend, and therefore he recommended that Donaldson be allowed to enter an outpatient treatment program rather than being required to receive treatment while incarcerated. During his cross-examination, Van Valkenburg noted that a big part of what Myers relied on to make a risk assessment was the personal history of the perpetrator. And to a large extent, Van Valkenburg argued, that means the perpetrator's criminal history. So, if someone has done bad things but has never gotten caught before, they come up as a low risk even if they've done a whole bunch of bad things that haven't gotten caught. That's true, Dr. Myers concurred. They could have 10 offenses and only been charged with one right now. That's a problem with risk assessment. Van Valkenburg reminded the court that 2 years before Beau Donaldson raped Allison Huggett, he'd attempted to rape Hillary McLaughlin. And were it not for the fact that the assault of McLaughlin was discovered in the course of this sentencing process, that would not be factored in at all. Myers agreed. Furthermore, he acknowledged, when he'd asked Donaldson about what had happened with McLaughlin, Donaldson had lied about it and insisted that he hadn't tried to rape her. This prompted Van Valkenburg to remind Dr. Myers that during his evaluation of Beau Donaldson, Donaldson had also lied about what he'd done to Huggett. So wasn't it pretty odd, Van Valkenburg demanded, after he had already entered a guilty plea, that he was essentially telling you he had consensual sex with Allison Huggett? Yes, and I asked him about that, Myers replied. I said, how can you go and say you're guilty in the plea agreement, and here you are telling me you're not guilty? Donaldson tried to explain away the lie by telling another lie. He claimed he didn't know that Huggett was asleep when he had sex with her and learned that she was unconscious only after the fact. As Van Valkenburg was wrapping up his questioning, he asked Dr. Myers about an entry-level treatment program for drug and alcohol dependency that Donaldson, after he'd been arrested, had completed with a clinical social worker named Paul Sells. Van Valkenburgh wondered if Myers knew what the treatment provided by cells consisted of.
Not really, Dr. Myers answered. I know it's more of an education thing and also trying to get people to express and talk about their feelings.
And that's where Beau ran into some trouble. He has a hard time talking about his feelings, expressing his emotions, which kind of goes along with the mold a lot of us guys are cut from, I guess. Anyhow, that was a problem for him within therapy.
He certainly never got involved in any community sex offender treatment, did he?
Van Valkenburgh asked.
No, Myers answered. He never did.
I have no other questions, Van Valkenburgh told the court.
But before Judge Townsend excused Dr. Myers from the witness stand, she wanted to ask him some questions of her own.
Myers, it turned out, had talked to both Paul Sells and Beau Donaldson about the efficacy of Donaldson's treatment for chemical dependency. Townsend asked Myers if Sells had given him sort of a different picture of how successful the therapy had been compared to the picture Donaldson had provided.
He did, Your Honor, Myers said.
In fact, he said it didn't go as well as Beau told you, right? Judge Townsend inquired.
That's right.
Townsend asked if Sells had told Dr. Myers that Donaldson was not adept at processing feelings and engaging in any real therapy.
He did say that, Your Honor, Myers confirmed.
So, how is he going to take advantage of any kind of therapy if he won't do it? Townsend asked.
According to Paul Sells, Myers answered, it wasn't so much that Beau didn't see a need for treatment, it's just that, yes, he does have a hard time processing things. There's a lot of shame and guilt, embarrassment, humiliation where he is. He's having a hard time talking about that.
Dr. Myers pointed out, however, that Beau Donaldson's willingness to actively engage in therapy, including sex offender therapy, would probably be different if it were required as part of his sentence.
When somebody is court-ordered to complete treatment, Myers said, they learn to talk pretty quickly and express feelings and start dealing with things.
Because there is a hammer over their head? Townsend asked.
Yeah, Myers answered.
The final two witnesses for the defense were Beau Donaldson and his father, Larry Donaldson. Larry appeared on the stand first, with his wife standing silently beside him. Looking exhausted, he said of his son, "He is a young man. He's remorseful. That doesn't, you know, make it right. Let him make it right. He will. And there's no reason to hate. I can't hate anyone, because I can't heal if I hate you, and we have to heal." Addressing the Hugetts, Larry Donaldson said, "The Huguette family and the Donaldson family have to heal, or will fail. And I want to heal. And I want Beau to be responsible to help your daughter heal. And he will, as she asked. I know that's a big thing to ask, but he will help her heal. And Allison, I've known you forever. It made me cry. It makes me cry when I look at my boy. But I can forgive my son because I know the love in his heart. You know, alcohol won again. It's a very destructive deal. I don't drink. I haven't drank since my kids were born. I didn't teach them to drink, and I don't condone drinking. And give him a chance. Let him understand what it does."
Whatever has went on in this community over the past year regarding the slandering of Allison has nothing to do with Beau, or instigated by Beau, or instigated by me, or my wife, or my family. I mean, when it happens, what's involved again? Alcohol. That's when we hate each other, is when we drink. And I love my boy. I'll see you soon, I hope sooner than later. I'll be your rock now, because you've been my rock all your life.
Finally, it was Beau Donaldson's turn to address the court.
I just want to start off by apologizing to everyone involved, he said in a faltering voice, most first to Allison and her family and her close friends, and secondly, my family and friends and everyone that this has affected. And I hope that me being here and apologizing helps Allison heal, helps her with what she has lost by me breaking our friendship that night by taking advantage of her.
When Donaldson returned to the defense counsel's table, Fred Van Valkenburgh stood to make his closing statement.
Your Honor, this case is an extremely good example of what rape often really looks like, he began.
Most rapes, he explained, involve people who know each other, and there is a huge violation of trust when that occurs. When you read the letters that have been submitted on behalf of Bo Donaldson, you'd think we were talking about whether he should get the Most Valuable Player award or he should just be excused for having made a mistake. And I think that comes about, by and large, because I don't think Bo Donaldson has been honest. He hasn't been honest with his own family. He hasn't been honest with the people that he knows best. He hasn't been honest with the community of Missoula as to what he actually did. He's having to finally face up to what he did, and it's very difficult for him to do that. It's very moving when he's on the witness stand telling people how sorry he is. But if you go back to the very first witness in this sentencing hearing, Mr. Huguette, it's also very moving to see what Bo Donaldson did to the Huguette family. The state has agreed to make a recommendation of 30 years in the Montana State Prison with 20 years suspended. That's what I recommend the court do. Mr. Donaldson will become eligible for parole within 2.5 years of the time that he starts serving that sentence. I think that will give him the time and the opportunity to complete, without a doubt, sex offender treatment. According to Montana's sentencing policy, Van Valkenburg noted, the very first thing the court should consider is to punish each offender commensurate with the nature and degree of harm caused by the offense, and to hold the offender accountable. We've had cases where the court has had to sentence people to as much as 100 years in prison for a rape, and to deny parole eligibility. The state is not asking for anything like that in this case. But what we're asking for is a very reasonable sentence, one that I think reflects the seriousness of the offense Mr. Donaldson committed. It's not just Allison Huguette that he's offended. We know that he's done this to at least one other person. People in Missoula need to know that if you rape an acquaintance, it is a serious crime, and that there needs to be a punishment that fits the crime. Milt Datsopoulos, as Bo Donaldson's lawyer, was given the opportunity to have the final word. As he delivered his closing statement, he brought to mind a quarterback scrambling to throw one last Hail Mary pass. This is one of those cases that's unusually difficult because a good person committed a tragic and very serious criminal activity that wounded a young lady, Datsopoulos offered. And she's going to continue to need assistance and time to try to heal and get on with her life. I'm not trying to diminish that. The fact of the matter is, the punishment that has occurred already is massive here. The shame, the humiliation, the destruction of a reputation. All I'm asking the court to do is look at the broad, available forms of punishment and tailor that punishment not only to the crime, but to the defendant. This system of criminal justice in the United States is insane. We've got a country that sentences more people, particularly young people, to prison per capita than any country in the world, and they get sentenced for a longer period than any other country in the world. I'm talking about countries like Uganda and Venezuela. And this is part of what happens when you take young people and you use a meat cleaver like Mr. Van Valkenburg wants to be used here. What I'm recommending is 5 years at the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections is part of the Montana State Prison System. If you sentence him to the Department of Corrections, he doesn't walk out of here with a slap on the wrist. He's taken out of here in handcuffs. He's taken to an incarceration facility that in many ways is much tougher than a prison, because you're in very tight quarters with extraordinary rules, and you're there for 6 months to a year. When Datsopoulos finished, Judge Townsend thanked him, then addressed the perpetrator. "So, Mr. Donaldson," she asked, "is there anything additional you want to say before I impose sentencing?" "No," Bo Donaldson replied meekly. "Would you stand, please?" she ordered. When Donaldson was on his feet, she said, "The court finds this an incredibly troubling case, because I think what has happened here is that a young woman's trust has been violently taken away from her, and in a way that has caused substantial damage to her, and that the impact of the act has had substantial impact on her family. My recollection is that one of the witnesses who testified today wished that he were Superman, where he could turn the world backwards and prevent this night from ever happening at all. I've often wished that I had a magic wand, that I could wipe away the kind of hurt that has happened to somebody, and even for folks accused of crimes, so that they don't have to face these kinds of consequences. But, Bo, there are consequences for your behavior. Even though you have lived a pretty good life up until this point, there is absolutely no excuse for what you did this night. It's hard for this court to accept that it was just a mistake, like making a wrong turn someplace or adding up something incorrectly. The court will sentence you to the Montana State Prison for the period of 30 years with 20 of those years suspended. You're remanded to the custody of the sheriff for imposition of sentence. As Judge Townsend pronounced his fate, Beau Donaldson's body went slack and he began to weep. His girlfriend screamed hysterically from the gallery. A detention officer cuffed Donaldson's hands behind his back, then escorted him from the courtroom through a side door. Upon exiting the courthouse, he was taken to jail to await transport to Deer Lodge, an 85-mile drive down the frozen interstate. That evening, Hillary McLaughlin found herself in an unfamiliar state of mind. She wasn't anxious. She decided to share this wonderful development with Allison Huguet, with whom she had never previously communicated. "I texted Allison," she said. "I told her it was the first time in 4 years I had felt at peace. Until that moment, I hadn't realized how much my life had been affected by Beau attacking me." Testifying against Donaldson had been incredibly stressful for McLaughlin, she acknowledged. "I think the worst part was having to appear in front of everybody and say, 'My name is Hillary McLaughlin,' and then start telling my story. But now I'm so glad I did it." McLaughlin was silent for a moment. She glanced down at her hands, then looked up with a pained expression and told me, "I think back, and Allison tells me not to do this, but I wonder if I had reported what Beau did to me right after he did it. Maybe I could have prevented her from being raped." Part 5. Trial by Jury. The U.S. legal system is organized as an adversarial contest. In civil cases, between two citizens, in criminal cases, between a citizen and the state. Physical violence and intimidation are not allowed in court, whereas aggressive argument, selective presentation of the facts, and psychological attack are permitted, with the presumption that this ritualized hostile encounter offers the best method of arriving at the truth. Constitutional limits on this kind of conflict are designed to protect criminal defendants from the superior power of the state, but not to protect individual citizens from one another. All citizens are presumed to enter the legal arena on an equal footing, regardless of the real advantages that one of the parties may enjoy. The Constitution, therefore, offers strong guarantees for the rights of the accused, but no corresponding protection for the rights of crime victims. As a result, victims who choose to seek justice may face serious obstacles and risks to their health, safety, and mental health. Judith Lewis Herman, The Mental Health of Crime Victims. Journal of Traumatic Stress, April 2003. Chapter 21. On March 16, 2012, 10 months before Beau Donaldson was sent to prison for raping Allison Huguet, Cecilia Washburn reported to the Missoula police that she had been raped by Donaldson's teammate, Jordan Johnson. At the time, Johnson was already being investigated by the University of Montana for allegedly raping Washburn. On May 23, 2012, the university court issued a ruling that Johnson was guilty of rape. On June 6, after reviewing the court's decision, President Royce Engstrom ordered him expelled. On July 31, 2012, while Jordan Johnson's expulsion from the university was under confidential appeal, Missoula County prosecutors filed court documents charging him with sexual intercourse without consent, a criminal charge that potentially had far more serious consequences than expulsion. If found guilty, Johnson could be sent to prison for life. On August 7, 2012, a week after the criminal rape charge against Jordan Johnson was filed, Johnson's lawyers filed a motion in Montana District Court to dismiss the case. It caught more than a few Missoulians by surprise when they noticed that the motion had been written by Kirsten Pabst. As Chief Deputy Missoula County Attorney, Pabst had been Fred Van Valkenburg's second-in-command, in charge of prosecuting sexual assaults. In March 2012, the same month Cecilia Washburn went to the police to report that she was raped by Johnson, Kirsten Pabst unexpectedly resigned from the Missoula County Attorney's Office after 15 years on the job to start her own law firm. In a Missoulian article announcing her decision to leave, She explained that a solo practice would allow her more flexibility and more free time. "I want to focus on my family and horses and dogs," she told reporter Gwen Florio. So it came as a shock when, scarcely a month later, Pabst quietly joined forces with lawyer David Paoli as defense counsel for Jordan Johnson, in a case that was expected to culminate in one of the most viciously contested and highly publicized trials in the history of Missoula. When the trial got underway, Pabst would be using her considerable expertise against her former colleagues in the prosecutor's office to keep Johnson from joining Bo Donaldson in prison. Had she remained in office, Kirsten Pabst probably would have been the lead prosecutor in the Johnson rape case. Her motion on August 7th to dismiss the criminal charge against him was the first public indication that instead she intended to do everything in her power to help Jordan Johnson beat the rap. Pabst's motion was the opening salvo in this battle. In asking the court to throw out the case, Pabst argued that there was a lack of probable cause to sustain the charge of sexual intercourse without consent. This, of course, was the same reason Pabst gave for refusing to charge Calvin Smith with raping Caitlin Kelly back in November 2011, when Pabst was still a prosecutor. According to the Department of Justice's investigation of the Missoula County Attorney's Office, from January 2008 through April 2012, the Missoula Police Department referred 114 reports of sexual assault of adult women to the MCAO for prosecution. A referral indicated that the police department had completed its investigation of the case in question, determined that there was probable cause to charge the individual accused of sexual assault, and recommended that the case be prosecuted. Of the 114 sexual assaults referred for prosecution, however, the MCAO filed charges in only 14 of those cases. The reasons most often given for declining to prosecute were insufficient evidence or insufficient corroboration, that is, lack of probable cause. Kirsten Pabst was in charge of sexual assault cases for all but the final 2 months of the 52-month period investigated by the DOJ. Throughout the United States, decisions about whether or not to file charges in sexual assault cases are generally left up to the discretion of prosecutors, who enjoy nearly complete immunity from both criminal and civil liability for their decisions, especially when they decline to prosecute. If a prosecutor doesn't want to pursue a case, she can simply state that there is insufficient probable cause and the case will not be prosecuted. Although this leaves victims with no recourse when their cases are disqualified, prosecutors will argue that such wide latitude is necessary to keep the wheels of the criminal justice system turning. But it isn't so easy to dismiss a case for lack of probable cause when you are no longer a prosecutor, as Kirsten Pabst discovered after she went to work as a defense lawyer for Jordan Johnson. As counsel for the accused, she needed the sanction of a judge to make the charges against her client disappear. In the motion Pabst submitted to the court seeking dismissal of the Johnson case, she argued that the charging documents filed by Van Valkenburgh's office, the state, presented a materially incomplete and misleading version of the facts. The state then sent the incomplete, misleading, and prejudicial document to multiple members of the media. Such conduct violates Johnson's right to due process. Based upon this conduct and considering the omitted and corrected facts that should have been contained in the charging documents, dismissal is the only appropriate remedy. This case has arisen in the unfortunate context and under the cloud of a federal Department of Justice investigation into complaints about how the University of Montana, the Missoula City Police Department, and the Missoula County Prosecutor's Office handle cases involving alleged sexual assault. Understandably, the state would like to demonstrate its reflexive and compassionate response to victims of sexual crimes. Unfortunately, while multitudes of competent and noble exercises of prosecutorial discretion go unnoticed, Kirsten Pabst is congratulating herself here for the many cases she declined to prosecute when she ran the sexual assault division at the Missoula County Attorney's Office. The state has chosen to use Jordan's case, one which lacks probable cause, as a means to try to send a message. The collateral damage to Jordan and his family is immeasurable. Because the state's grounds for charging Jordan are based entirely upon the alleged victim's statements, the contradictions of her story would have completely undercut the alleged probable cause for the crime. 2 weeks after Pabst filed her motion to dismiss, Chief Prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburg responded with a brief protesting that she had filed a thinly veiled press release under the guise of a legal proceeding. Her motion is rife with irrelevant, unnecessary, prejudicial, and objectively inadmissible evidence. A pretrial motion is not the place to dispute the state's evidence, offer alternative interpretations of the evidence, or make determinations of witness credibility. Determinations of witness credibility lie squarely with the province of the jury. Nor is a pretrial motion an appropriate way to make a claim that a rape victim did not act like a rape victim should. Judge Karen Townsend, whose job it was to rule on Pabst's motion to dismiss, found Van Valkenburg's argument more cogent than Pabst's. In a court order dated September 5, 2012, Townsend decreed, "The court does not believe that the state omitted material facts. Looking at everything using common sense and drawing permissible inferences, the court concludes that there is a fair probability that the defendant committed the offense of sexual intercourse without consent. For the reasons outlined above, defendant's motion to dismiss is denied." On February 6, 2013, 2 days before the trial of Jordan Johnson was scheduled to begin, reporter Jim Robbins observed in a piece published in the New York Times, "Mr. Johnson's trial comes on the heels of the sentencing of a former Grizzlies running back, Bo Donaldson, who pleaded guilty to raping a childhood friend in 2010 as she slept in his apartment. Questions have been raised about whether Mr. Johnson can get a fair trial amid such controversy. Court officials have assembled an extra-large pool of 400 for the jury selection that begins Friday. You have to believe that the presumption of innocence is somehow affected," said Milt Detsopoulos, who represented Mr. Donaldson and is also on the National Advisory Board for Grizzly Athletics, a booster organization. He believes that his client's sentence was more severe than it would have been had there not been what he called a toxic atmosphere in Missoula. "They made him a poster child for a supposed major problem," Mr. Detsopoulos said of Mr. Donaldson. "I don't think a problem exists." Detsopoulos expanded on his theme in an article by Lester Munson posted on ESPN.com on February 8th. "The mess that has developed is an unfortunate thing," said Detsopoulos. "The accusation that the county attorney has not pursued cases against football players is totally not true. It is now hard to get a fair trial. The presumption of innocence has been flip-flopped, and football players are now presumed to be guilty. Instead of preferential treatment for football players," Detsopoulos asserts, "the prosecutors are very aggressive in their cases against football players and in their demands for stiff sentences. The deputies in the office of the county attorney are female and activist, and they make every case a matter of women's rights and a gender issue." "It is certain," Detsopoulos said, "that the environment created in Missoula is responsible for the 10-year sentence. Donaldson did the right thing. He is a quality guy. He told the police what he did, he wanted to clear it up, and it has cost him dearly." Contrary to the spin provided by Milt Detsopoulos in advance of Jordan Johnson's trial, however, the combination of Johnson's status as such a cherished member of the Grizz and the fact that the trial was being held in Missoula almost certainly worked to Johnson's advantage. The town is known as Grizzlyville for good reason, a point driven home by the public outcry ignited by a statement made by Pat Williams, a University of Montana alumnus and a member of the Montana Board of Regents of Higher Education, the body that oversees the state university system. Williams, who represented Montana in the U.S. Congress from 1979 to 1997, told Lester Munson, "The football team was recruiting too many thugs. Rape was not the only problem. There was vandalism, there were personal assaults, and there was destruction of property. The players were pampered and adored. Too many of them had the feeling they were bulletproof and immune to the rules that all of us must follow. They acted like arrogant marauders." Williams's comments to Munson about thuggery, and similar comments Williams made to the New York Times and to Montana radio station, angered Grizz fans, who circulated a petition demanding that he be kicked off the Board of Regents. Jury selection for State of Montana versus Jordan Todd Johnson commenced on Friday morning, February 8, 2013, and was completed on midday the following Monday, February 11th, with 7 women and 5 men being seated in the jury box. After a break for lunch, the trial got underway with opening statements from each side. The prosecution went first. This case is about a young woman who was horribly betrayed by someone that she trusted. Special Deputy Missoula County Attorney Adam Dirk began. There is one person on trial in this matter, not Grizzly Football, not that young woman who accused Mr. Johnson of the crime. The only person who was on trial, Dirk made clear, was Jordan Johnson, and he had been charged with sexual intercourse without consent. Dirk emphasized to the jury that according to Montana law, resistance by the victim is not required to show lack of consent. Force, fear, or threat is sufficient alone to show lack of consent. And then he provided a detailed account of what happened in Cecilia Washburn's bedroom on the night of February 4, 2012. Dirk, a slender man in his early 40s with curly black hair, was an expert litigator at a Missoula law firm. He'd been appointed as a special prosecutor to assist the Missoula County Attorney's Office during the Jordan Johnson trial and was working pro bono. In his opening statement, his task was to tell a brief story to the jury based on the evidence to be presented in the days ahead that would be more compelling than the story defense counsel Kirsten Pabst would be telling immediately after he finished. Everyone knew that the main thrust of Adam Dirk's opening statement would be that Washburn explicitly and repeatedly told Johnson that she didn't want to have sex with him that night. Everyone knew that the main thrust of Pabst's opening statement would be that Washburn consented to have sex with Johnson. Cecilia Washburn was lying, or Jordan Johnson was lying. Or perhaps both of them were misrepresenting key details of their respective accounts. There wasn't enough incontrovertible evidence to prove whose version came closest to the truth, however. The outcome of the trial would thus hinge on bits of tangential substantiation and the testimony of individuals who weren't in Washburn's bedroom when the alleged rape occurred. Most of the evidence was subject to conflicting interpretations. Whoever assembled the most persuasive narrative from these disjointed shards of information, whoever told the best story, in other words, was most likely to sway the jury. The opening statements would be bare-bone summaries of the full-length narratives each side intended to flesh out as the trial ran its course. Many of the details of what transpired between Washburn and Johnson were undisputed. Johnson texted Washburn at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on February 4th, and they formulated a plan to watch a movie at Washburn's residence that night. Around 10:45 p.m., Johnson phoned Washburn and asked her to give him a ride to her house. She drove over, picked him up, and then drove back to her place. Around 11 o'clock, they went into her bedroom, closed the door, and inserted a movie into her DVD player. Washburn's housemate Stephen Green was slumped on a couch just outside the door, engrossed in a video game. Soon after the movie started, Jordan Johnson and Cecilia Washburn began making out, they took each other's shirts off, and had sex without a condom. The intercourse lasted only a few minutes. While Johnson was penetrating Washburn from behind, he realized he was about to climax, withdrew his penis from Washburn's vagina, and ejaculated into his hand. Immediately after ejaculating, Johnson wiped the semen off his hand and his penis, gathered his clothing, and went into an adjacent bathroom. While he was in the bathroom, Washburn pulled on her own clothes and then sent a text to Green that said, "OMG, I think I might have just gotten raped." He kept pushing and pushing, and I said no, but he wouldn't listen. "I just want to cry. OMG, what do I do?" A few minutes later, Washburn drove Johnson home. On many of these points, Prosecutor Dirk told the jury, there is very little difference in the account between Cecilia's version and the defendant's version. Dirk emphasized, however, that when it came to a handful of crucial details, their accounts of what happened diverged in ways that couldn't be reconciled. "She'll tell you that before anyone's pants came off," Dirk said, "before the defendant was on top of her, before there was any penetration at all, she told him no, multiple times, in multiple ways. She said, 'No, not tonight.' Playfully at first, but then as things got more heated, she made it clear through words and actions that she did not want to have sex." "She'll take the stand," Dirk continued, "and tell you that she was very clear with the defendant, but the defendant kept going. He positioned himself on top of her. His demeanor changed. He became more aggressive. And, in her words, it got real scary, real fast. Again, she said no. The defendant put his forearm across her chest and held her down. He stripped her leggings and underwear off. Her underwear was still hooked on her ankle. She began to push him away. The defendant said, "Turn over or I'll make you." At that point, Cecilia continued to resist. She was scared. She was in shock. She was starting to shut down. But even then she said no. And then he did flip her over, he penetrated her,